welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. I'm Karen Tate, and tonight's musical offering opening the show was Let the Way Be Open by Abigail Spinner McBride, a prayer of sorts, or I see it in that way anyhow, for us to be open to the enlightenment that can shift us away from a curiarchal world. That's a world of oppression. Whether we're a woman in the Middle East at risk of having acid thrown in her face or a woman here in the United States whose rights and progress we've managed to achieve, which is under threat right now by conservatives and Republican Party. So let's let the way be open to divine guidance all around, including that guidance offered by my guest tonight. After our show housekeeping, we'll be interviewing at the top of the show K.D. Farris and Gary Bobroff, who will help us recognize the archetypes that lie behind what motivates us and provides us with our greatest satisfaction in the world. And we'll have some fun because we're also going to talk about how we can recognize archetypes at work motivating others in our lives or people or groups on the world scene. Then a little bit more self-help toward the bottom of the hour. We're going to have Crystal Blanton come on about 7 o'clock Pacific in about an hour, discussing responsible priestessing. That's going to be our topic. But before we begin these juicy conversations, I want to tell you this past weekend, I headed to the conference put on by the American Academy of Religion held at Whittier College. Well, I felt honored to have my paper accepted by the Goddess Studies panel. It was titled The Politics of Ecofeminist Goddess Spirituality, a Theology for a Sustainable Future. Now, for those of you who couldn't make the conference, I actually have this talk up on my YouTube channel. It's on my Facebook page. And if you can't find it either of those places and want to hear it, see it, email me at KarenTate.com. I'm happy to share it. I think it's very relevant for today. The opening phrase is, Goddess is a Democrat. And as I promised, in honor of Keith Olbermann of Countdown fame, formerly on MSNBC, who we know will be back in June as the news director on Al Gore's current TV, I'll ask the question I surely think he would have asked every night, and that question is, Mr. Boehner, where are the jobs? We thought you were so concerned, or so you told the voters, but all you and the GOP seem interested in is culture war issues, fighting women trying to take away their rights, fighting workers trying to take away their rights, fighting for no one, Mr. Boehner, but your rich overlords who put you in office. Shame on you for giving the richest people in the country tax breaks while you try to take away social safety nets for Americans who have been suffering because corporations have been steadily shipping jobs overseas as they get rich. Shame on you. You and your party are economic terrorists causing suffering around this country, but we aren't all asleep. And more wake up every day. You know those ones marching in the street across the country? Well, with that in mind, I'd like to share this reading that I've sort of titled The Big Sleep. It doesn't really have a title, but it's written by Gary Amstutz. He wrote it after he was inspired by the Japan nuclear reactors melting down and the aftermath of that 8.9 earthquake. I think it's relevant considering the crimes being perpetrated upon the people. I read it before a few weeks ago, and you liked it so much you wanted to hear it again. So here goes. It goes like this. And remember, I call it the big sleep. Nuclear power is safe. Fracking is safe. Offshore drilling is safe. Coal mining is safe. Air pollution is safe. Corporations always tell the truth. The moon is made of cream cheese. Santa Claus will bring you everything you need. All toxic chemicals will soon be available in a vitamin pill at a store near you. It's better for the rich to get richer and the poor to get poorer. People should expect to sacrifice to live in a country that has the best of everything, like health care, although we're 47th in longevity, 54th in equal treatment and access, like education, even though we're 12th in high school graduates of all OECD countries. But you're getting drowsy. Sleep, sleep, sleep. Rush Limbaugh is the all-knowing, all-seeing eye of humanity. The free market will solve all problems known to man, like corporate greed, Ponzi schemes, Wall Street cheaters, disappearing benefits and pension plans. Corporations are free to cheat. It's called freedom. sleep, sleep, sleep. Do exactly what you're told to do. Offer blind obedience to all leaders. You were born to suffer quietly. Fall in line. March in lockstep. Don't ask any questions. Shh. Solar panels and wind generators are a communist plot to take over the world. Black is white, up is down, war is peace. Just let go and coast right off the cliff. It won't hurt at all. It's the patriotic thing to do. Sleep, sleep, sleep. Shh. Well, that was written by Gary Anstuss. And I thank the folks who sent that to me, and I'm glad you like that. Well, I also want to thank Christina Smith for sending me this call to prayer for people around the world, suggested by Masaru Emoto. You may know him as the scientist who proved to us praying to water changes molecular structure. Well, Dr. Emoto is calling to people all around the world to join their energy in prayers of love and gratitude to water, especially at the nuclear plants in Fukushima, Japan. And if you miss the time and date, which is tomorrow, March 31st at noon in your time zone, you know what? Just do it whenever you hear about this. You know, of course, if you can do it tomorrow, that's great, but any time would be fine. The waters can always take your blessing. So here are actually Dr. Emoto's words that he recommend tomorrow people around the world say aloud to help bless the waters. Please say the following phrase. The water of Fukushima nuclear plant, we are sorry to make you suffer. Please forgive us. We thank you and we love you. Please say it aloud or in your mind. Repeat it three times as you put your hands together in a prayer position and just offer your sincere prayer, your prayers from your heart. I'll repeat it for you again. It's very simple, and I'm sure you could do your own version of it. It goes like this. The water of Fukushima nuclear plant, we are sorry to make you suffer. Please forgive us. We thank you and we love you. And you know what? For that matter, you can do that about the water in the Gulf. You can do it about the polluted waters in your backyard. The waters around the world are in trouble. We really need this prayer for the waters on the entire planet. So that comes from Dr. Masaru Emoto, and he's calling to all people of the world to join together. And what a powerful event that could potentially be. Well, new developments quickly here before we get to our first guest tonight. I want you to know or remember, if you haven't heard, Blog Talk is no longer free to host like myself. It was up until the beginning of this year, but now they've started charging us, so we are looking for a sponsor or people to send in occasional monthly contributions. Remember, like Goddess teaches us, what you tend to nurture, nourish, well, it thrives, and what you neglect, well, sometimes it withers. Thanks to those of you who have already sent in donations. But here I am sounding like PBS on a fundraising drive. Please support us to keep us on the air. If you'd like to make contributions, go to the Goddess Store page of my website at KarenTate.com. And there are PayPal buttons. You can make a donation of any amount you can afford. And please be sure to remember the three F's. I would love it if you would mark Voices of the Sacred Feminine a favorite. Be sure to become our friend. And probably most important is follow. Click the follow button on my show page on Blog Talk so that you never miss notice of any of my new guests each week. That way you're definitely a part of our growing family of listeners across the globe. And the last announcements I want to make is I want to make sure I tell you about the tour I'm leading to Turkey in November for men and women. Turkey, or Anatolia as it was once called, which meant the land of the nourishing mothers. I'm taking a group, no more than 20. We're going to be going to places like Istanbul, Ephesus, Şatıl Hayup, Side, Lagina, where we find Hecate's only standing temple known to modern man. We'll do activities like dream incubations, rituals at the site, sacred shopping, Turkish baths, partaking of mineral springs near the domain of Aphrodite outside Aphrodisias, and lots more. So if that sounds like something you're interested in, if you're hearing the call for a sacred journey, maybe to satisfy your mind, your body, or your soul, again, go back to my website, KarenTate.com. There's a page there for sacred travel. And you can find an itinerary and also a link to a YouTube video we have up that shows some wonderful glimpses of the last trip we took. So don't hesitate. If you want to secure your place on the tour, we've had good response, and I'm sure the trip is going to fill early. So if you want to make sure you get a spot, don't wait too long to make up your mind. And don't forget, if you're listening live and want to call in and talk to my fabulous guests or myself, the number is 718-766-4662. I know most of you listen from the archives, but if you want to call in, when I see you on the switchboard, I'll get to you when we have a lapse in the conversation, and I'll invite you to give your comment or your question, and I will identify you by your area code. All right, then. So now, thanks to my two guests on the line. We have two guests at the top of the hour. They're going to be talking about archetypes. The first is K.D. Farris, and let me tell you a little bit about K.D. She's an author, speaker, workshop leader. Her roots as a counselor, healer, and body worker have seeded over the last 25 years, bringing substance and depth to her one-on-one work. She specializes in process-oriented consciousness work, a means by which to enter safely and deeply into the inner landscape of the psyche for positive and real-world change. She has a master's degree in Jungian-oriented psychology from Pacifica Graduate Institute of Santa Barbara, California, and is currently completing her doctoral dissertation there. KD is a contributing developer and co-lead facilitator of the Archetypes of the Feminine and Masculine Workshop. A trained actor and charismatic speaker, KD makes seemingly complex principles of life accessible and poignant for both men and women alike, and she's the author of Me, She, He, She, Me, Sun, and Orbit, What My Grandmother Taught Me About the Universe. And her website is MeShe.com. And our co-interview with KD is Gary Bulbroff. Gary has a master's degree in Jungian-oriented psychology, also from Pacifica Graduate Institute in Santa Barbara. So he's a certified administrator of the Myers-Briggs Type Indicator and has been working with personality type and archetype since 94. He's the primary developer and co-lead facilitator of the same workshop I just mentioned that of KD's. They do it together. Wonderful workshop called The Archetypes of the Feminine and Masculine. A dynamic and engaging speaker, he speaks and leads workshops internationally. He's also the author of an upcoming publication on Jung, Crop Circles and the Archetypal Feminine. His website for that work is jungandcropcircles.net. Well, KD, Gary, thank you for being with me tonight.
Thank you for having us, Karen.
Hi.
Well, let's start with you, KD. Why don't we, you know, for people who maybe, you know, don't really know exactly what the definition of archetype is, you know, and why, you know, and why they should maybe understand it. Could you, you know, tell us what you mean by archetype? Sort of define it for us.
Well, there's a general usage, a general Jungian usage, and a particular usage, and I'll share both with you. Our work is based on both of these. In general, Jung talked about archetypes being a natural primordial structure of the psyche. Well, they're a part of the collective unconscious, which he describes the collective unconscious as a place where we are all related in our essential blueprint, and it sits just under the personal unconscious that we each have as individuals. This collective unconscious is universally shared, and themes of myth and legend and story worldwide, the commonality in those is what you see emerging from this collective space, and these myths and the characters populating these myths are these archetypal structures themselves.
Could you maybe give some examples of these archetypal structures that maybe might give a little bit more context to the definition?
The hero, the princess, the queen, these are all words and images and particular modes of behavior come up similarly when all of us think about these particular terms. So the character of a hero is archetypal in our minds. The hero is the one who perseveres, always gets to the end, saves the day, as it were.
So you could almost think of him as a role model. When you hear the word hero, you sort of know what that means. If you want to aspire to be a hero, well, that ideal of of a hero is sort of forged on our psyche.
Yes, and they can be of positive and negative impressions, these archetypes. But they tend to be predictable patterns of a journey. So a mode of behavior, an arc of maturation is another way to look at it.
So, all right, well, we're going to get more into our personal archetypes and other people's archetypes, but do you find that a person sort of carries around one archetype that comprises who they are, or are they more of a sort of a mixed bag of more than one?
Well, if you look at the definition of Toni Wolff, who talks about the particular, she goes to a little more of the particular usage of the archetype. I think that ways of being, these structural forms of the psyche, how we identify our deepest needs, how we fulfill ourselves on the deepest levels, how we experience our deepest satisfaction, these more particular forms. I think that's sort of where the archetypes that we're looking at in our work come into play.
Okay. All right, well, let me throw a question over to Gary. Gary, our modern understanding of archetype, does it come from Jung?
Yeah, it's primarily from Jung. And I want to say the intro to the show was just great. Thank you for leading us in that way. And the poem you read was just amazing, so thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
Yeah, so Jung definitely has been the pioneer that gave us all of the, even the term archetype really has been popularized through Jung's work. So, in terms of who Jung was, for people that don't know, Carl Jung was Freud's heir apparent, and they were working together at the beginning of the 20th century and split off around issues of sexuality versus spirituality. And Jung really felt that there was a spiritual principle that was inherent in human nature, and Jung really, and Freud on the other hand, really felt that sexuality was repressed. Sexuality was the reason for a lot of our religious urges and artistic creative needs and that sort of thing. So when Jung left, it was really around this issue of spirituality, and one of the key elements that he found in what he called the collective unconscious were archetypes, were these forms. Natural forms of, energy or pattern that are found in the psyche and in nature all through it. And, a few other things that people don't understand about Jung is he sort of lies behind the whole popularization of dreams and the unconscious. That's, predominantly, Jung, was the pioneer there that has left us with the culture today that has an interest in dreams and the unconscious and that sort of thing. Jung also was the pioneer of personality type, and the terms introvert and extrovert come from Jung. And also synchronicity is a word Jung coined. And another piece, just so that the listeners get an idea about who Jung was, the issue around spirituality versus sexuality with Freud, when Bill W., the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, began a correspondence with Jung when he was starting the first 12-step program, Jung really encouraged him to include the spiritual component in the work, and that's why that spiritual component is alive and well in the 12-step program today. So Jung's a huge influence on the culture.
Okay. Obviously, I didn't know that about the AA. Well, KD, so Jung found saw the power of these archetypes, but they're mostly working unconsciously, though, right?
Yes, in fact, that is where their power lies. you know, if you, the collective unconscious is the place where the dream figures are coming into our awareness. It's the deepest place within the human psyche. And, you know, our characters are filled with these archetypal images and structures. And in this way, it's really more deeply rooted than, and far more deeply rooted than the human ego. So this, the conscious mind is sort of pales in comparison to the power of the unconscious.
Well, you know, this might sound like a silly question, but when I don't know, do you, either of you, ever get this 3 o'clock wake up call where you're just sort of sit up in bed alert and your mind is just kind of going crazy with ideas or connecting the dots or something like that? Is that the unconscious mind at work?
Yes, and I think it's also the unconscious processes of taking information and connecting systems that are thriving to each other and producing like a third, fourth, or fifth effect, something that our conscious mind might not produce, where it's going down into the depths, it's connecting with a lot of other thoughts, a lot of other experiences of the day, and a light bulb can go off.
Well, right.
In my experience of that, I mean, a lot of my best creative ideas come at the end of the day when you've been working on your work, you lie down, you relax, and suddenly, you know, from deep inside you, the unconscious can give you that piece that's been missing all day. So, you know, it may not be the busy mind that keeps you up at night, but there is another, you know, a deeper layer to consciousness there that can feed us the missing creative piece. You know, once we've sort of changed gears enough and allow that deeper sensibility to rise up in us.
You know,
Well, I was just going to say, yeah, that was sort of, at least personally, my sense of it was that, you know, sometimes these things that are coming through at 3 a.m. are coming from a different place, or, you know, just the texture of it is different than you get from the conscious mind.
Well, absolutely, and there's lots of examples of creativity coming through that way. The Beatles song Nowhere Man, John Lennon, talks about, you know, waking up from a dream having that song. And, you know, even Keith Richards talks about, you know, waking up at 3 in the morning and having a little tape recorder beside his bed that he played the riff for satisfaction into the tape recorder, and then there's 45 minutes of him snoring after that. So
those are great stories. Well, KD, were you about to say something?
I was going to say Jung had an inscription over his door, which translated reads, called or uncalled, the gods are present. And he's talking about the power of the archetypes in the unconscious, deep in the unconscious, that they really are more powerful than what we can reason through or try to behave our way around. And so this meeting the archetype and coming to honor the archetypes that are within your own psyche is a way of sort of giving a certain part of your life over to where the natural flow is going to be going, that part that, you know, whether you're aware of it or not, whether you're embracing it or not, is working through you.
Okay. And so from that quote, should we surmise that he is sort of equating that powerful, unconscious, archetypal, stuff that's at work? Was he equating that with God?
Not a supreme conscious single godhead, but the gods as in mythology. These powerful blueprints that do express and dictate and teach us about human behavior.
Well, now, Gary, I know from the workshop, or at least the little, you know, teaser, Joseph Campbell Foundation's talk you gave that sort of, you know, got us interested in this wonderful workshop that you do, that you and KD really have sort of a different take on these archetypes. So could you sort of briefly tell us how you're different than, I guess, just, from what's normally thought about archetypes?
Sure. Yeah, there's a lot of good writing out there that has insight on archetype, but a lot of those systems talk about archetype as a stage theory. So you do this stage, you do the warrior stage, and then you do the magician stage, and, you know, you're going to get to another stage. What we've really seen and what I've seen and what the people that founded the work that we do observe is that, you know, really there's one or two archetypes that play throughout a person's whole life that are the primary ways you find your identity, your satisfaction, your deepest fulfillment. The things that really motivate you in this world come from basically one or two archetypal angles. And, you know, everyone needs to have, you know, a bit of everything. Everyone needs some warrior in their life. Everyone needs, you know, a variety of archetypal pieces to be a full, complete human being. But we don't all live in the same place. And it's really important to identify where it is that you live and who you are, first of all, so that you're not living an identity that's not your own, that's not true to who you are. But also I think in claiming that ground, you know, you can really move towards maturity and have some relativity for the pieces that you're not as, you're not as easy in your facility with them. So, you know, if you own a certain piece of archetypal real estate, you know, you can forgive yourself of, you know, for not being perfect with another piece. And, you know, the thing for us is that basically it breaks down into two groups or two axes. One is a personal axis, and one's an impersonal axis. So there's some people that, you know, if you're on the personal axis, you're really finding part of your satisfaction in this world through relationships. But there's two different kinds of that we see that are really, you know, definitional in how this archetype system works. On what we call the top of the personal axis is the mother-father archetypes, or the you know, king and queen. And those are types of people, generally speaking, that find satisfaction in doing for others. So, you know, there might be a focus on collective values, on group activities, community involvement, you know, motherhood or parenthood, you know, literally. Those people are finding their energy and their fascination flowing into group systems. If they wake up at 3 a.m. with that, you know, buzzing the way you were talking about, it's going to be about groups. How does the new person fit in the group? How does the new kid in their class that they teach, if they're a teacher, how's the new kid fitting in the school, et cetera?
Okay.
On the other end of that is people that get satisfaction from doing with, and that's more one-on-one oriented, and that's a, you know, that's a different piece.
Okay. Well, from something you said a minute ago, it sounded like you might have been implying that sometimes we're not living out our authentic archetype that's meant for us. Does that mean, you know, our society, our family can force us into living out an archetype that's not really true to our inner being?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So a lot of people, you know, grow up in a certain parental, you know, system where their parents expect them to live in a certain archetype. So, you know, I just mentioned briefly the father archetype. So a father archetype may want his child to also live in a way that is, you know, fits with the father archetype. And if you're not that archetype, you know, you're going to have a lot of problems. And this is a lot of times where you end up with the black sheep and that kind of thing. But, you know, it certainly goes more complex than that. And, you know, we see a lot of people in our workshops talking about even things like, well, my father wasn't father archetype, but he thought he should be, and he acted that out from a place of, you know, being caught in an inauthentic story himself.
Mm-hmm.
And then expected me as the son to also live that inauthentic life. So, you know, it's quite deep, but, you know, it is exactly what you're saying, that a lot of times society or parents, you know, expect, you know, people or children to live.
Well, does that also fit in with, say, you know, the woman who's pushed into childbearing when she doesn't really feel called to be a mother, or maybe the son who gets stuck taking over the family business, but that's not really who he wants to be? Does this all sort of fit in with what you're talking about?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, we talk about, you know, in opposition to the mother-father, on the other end of the personal axis, we talk about the seeker and the companion are the names we give to the masculine and feminine story at the other end of the personal axis. And these are people who are motivated and fascinated with intimate relationships, one-on-one, romantic relationships, close friendships, you know, values that are personal and individual as opposed to collective with the mother and father archetype. And, you know, a lot of people that come to our work are, you know, we would call them, you know, under the name of the companion archetype, which is, you know, another story in opposition to the mother that is not going to find her whole satisfaction out of nurturing and motherhood and all that. And it's very powerful for women to hear that there's another eternal story that has been with us since the beginning of human existence.
You mean besides that, being stuck in the mother,
right.
The mother cubbyhole?
Exactly. And so, you know, for people that don't identify with the mother archetype, that there's another story out there that is one that's one-on-one based, and that's where their satisfaction lies. For them to claim that identity is very powerful because it helps you let go of a bunch of expectations that not only has society put on you, but that most people or most women have integrated, or a lot of women have integrated on their own into themselves, expectation that they feel like they should get complete satisfaction out of motherhood. And it's very powerful for us to see people have another story and say, you know what, I don't have to find all my, you know, deepest fulfillment through being a mother. There are other archetypal roles that are ancient and that are, you know, a deep part of human nature.
Well, and, you know, and I don't know, it probably won't come as a surprise to you, but in the circles I move in, you know, we look at mother as not just a childbearer either. You know, mother can be someone who births ideas, movements, books, groups. You know, so it doesn't have to be a flesh and blood child. Does that also fit into your, you know, the way you look at this?
There's completely. There's, I believe that many of the women working in corporate structures quite successfully are doing that because of their mother archetype, the part that of them that can see the collective and see the group, can head a group very successfully, keeping everybody on her team, feeling good about themselves in the roles that they should be in, holding things together, and and feeling very comfortable in charge of a group and taking them where they need to go successfully and fully.
But now, KD, I remember from that little brief intro workshop that you guys gave, there's also the dark side of the mother-father archetype, right?
Yes. There are the dark sides and immature sides to each one of these pieces. And with the mother-father, this ability to keep a group going and sustain a history and a culture can also lead to a narrow-mindedness and being too rigid in old thinking and old structures. The father can end up being very one way, you know, believing that it's, you know, my way or the highway, as it were, and mothers can be, you know, Jungian psychology talks about the devouring mother, but she can as easily be overbearing, not seeing those in her charge and in her care as being capable in and of themselves and really have a need for dependency of them upon her. The martyr is a classic sort of negative expression of the mother archetype. And there's a way in which this wonderful innate connection to responsibility that the mother and father have can turn and be really just a need to have power over others. In the father archetype, there's a tyrannical, you know, authoritative and over-identity with authority itself that can take place as well.
Well, you know, when you said the martyr mother, boy, did that just set off a bell in my head. I think that really must have been my mother and grandmother, because I think about every holiday, the family would get together for the big meal that mother and grandmother put together. And you know what? You almost felt like choking on it, because all they did was say about how they slaved over the stove.
Exactly.
You know, so I don't know, maybe that's the martyr mother.
Right, and now we've been talking about archetypes, and that's really expressing a negative archetypal pattern to a mother. And I think most people out there can relate to that. Oh, yeah, certain moms do that.
Yeah. Well, now, Gary, is there also a dark side for the seeker companion archetype?
Yeah, and, you know, it's very much in opposition to the other end. You know, if you're more of the, you know, the one-on-one type with the seeker and companion, more of the child archetype or more the lover archetype, you know, you're a very free spirit, but, you know, there's a big dark side there with a sort of lack of identity. If people know the movie Breakfast at Tiffany's, okay, that's a classic example of a companion archetype. She's full of life, full of zest, full of fun, but, you know, who's really there underneath all that charade, right? So the problem on the other end with these two sort of child-based archetypes can be too open, a lack of a strong enough ego, that kind of thing, not a resistance to actually coming into identity. And that can mean often for women, you know, it tends to be a little more, or one form of it can be more about, you know, getting projected onto by others, men thinking, you know, falling in love or being the perfect daughter, or projections from other people, you know, family or romantic partners. And with guys, it can be a refusal to come into form, you know, avoiding, you know, contributing, bringing your gifts to bear in terms of career until later in life, that kind of thing. And, you know, part of this points to, you know, what we really see clearly is that, you know, if you strongly identify with one archetype, you're probably going to find some of your shadow in the other archetype. So for me, I mean, personally, I'm not a father archetype, so I look to father and, you know, see my shadow pieces there a little bit. It means I have to learn to, you know, have stability and integrity and calmness and orderedness and all these sort of principles we'd see in the king, queen, or mother-father archetype.
Okay. Well, now, KD, when we're in a relationship with someone, does the archetype come into play that helps sort of shapes that dance we do with the other person?
Absolutely. There are, you know, our experience is that people who share wings, many times people will have two archetypes, one on the personal and one on the impersonal. And that if you have people of the same archetype or people who share at least one archetype, they tend to find a bit more harmony in their day-to-day living. Their sense of how they're relating to the world and each other is a bit similar. But at the same time, it can be very beneficial and very healing for somebody to be with the opposite archetype, especially as Gary was talking, you know, if we find our shadow there, and which also means our strength, and that it can be very healing and helpful to have, let's say, a seeker male who's not really gotten the love and attention from a mother at a young age. He might find a lot of solace and calm an essential sense of being, well-being within himself, to be with a woman who is a mother archetype. And provided they share an impersonal wing, which is how they're out in the world together, that can be very fulfilling.
Well, you know, as I'm hearing you say this, do psychologists use what we're talking about right now to sort of help people in therapy?
Well, the psychologists who come to our workshops are really pleased to find this information and find it really relevant. I know for myself, once I got this piece, I've been able to fold this into most of my work. I find there's a particular place in which this model helps me take some work that I'm doing with a client, maybe that I've been doing for a few years, and I add this model in, and it just takes them to that next level of understanding, just a deeper way of interpreting and seeing through a lens that helps them just make that final little piece of making of self-acceptance, or how to get out in the world, or how to understand themselves a little more complexly.
So if the archetype, you know, comes into play in relationships, I would imagine it must also have a place in childhood or early adulthood.
Yes, what's really kind of delightful about archetypes is that they tend to be very plain and very obvious in our childhood. Mother-father archetypes, you know, at a young age, they enjoy responsibility, they tend to sort of have a sense of who they are, they belong. The culture is so supportive of a mother-father archetype as well. Magician and some of the other ones that we haven't talked about yet on the impersonal axis of how you relate in the world, you really see you know, some children want to be out on the soccer field all day long, and others are in their rooms tinkering with things, taking them apart and trying to make them work. All this stuff happens
in
early age.
So if you're the kid on the soccer field, what's your archetype versus the kid that's tinkering in the room?
The impersonal axis, at one end, you have what we call the warrior Amazon. The warrior is the masculine, the Amazon is the feminine. And they are relating to the world through the external achievements. So, you know, athletics is a very strong one in childhood. But also making money in a lot of forms of executing business is also an external way of relating to the world. They're very achievement, goal-oriented. They thrive on competition and getting things done. They see nothing in the way between themselves and the goal. They just go, 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 go. On the other side, you have the magician media trick, the magician being a masculine and the media tricks or medium being the feminine expression. And these people are relating to the world through knowledge, through inner understanding. They're looking at how things work. Now, in this, you know, Jung is looking at the unconscious and how that works. An archaeologist is digging down on the ground to find the history and figure where things have been. Knowledge, know-how, a lot of psychotherapy is rooted in this internal world. Einstein, classic example of a magician.
Okay. Well, you know, I was I came in contact with this idea, I think a psychologist by the name of Eric Fromm, maybe. He said people are two different modalities. They're either, I forgot the two words he uses, but it means either, you know, some people live for experiences, and other people live to acquire things, and they sort of value themselves either by their assets and what they have, or by you know, I guess knowledge and experience. It seems like these, you know, the Amazon warrior versus the magician, that almost seems parallel to Eric Fromm, is it, or am I not really understanding it properly?
Yeah, it's not really. I mean, with the warriors, you may not be, you know, the warrior is also the surfer or the, you know, the person who really just lives to do what they do, you know, just do it like Nike, right?
Okay.
That's the warrior. So he may, you know, he may be on a possessive trip or he may not.
Okay.
You know, he may be hooked on consumerism and materialism or he may not. I mean, these are really deep archetypal principles and they're in every culture. So, you know, every culture's got a warrior and every culture's got a magician. And, you know, the magician definitely is more interested in the world of ideas than the warrior. And the warrior wants to be out there doing it, you know.
Okay. Yeah, so one's doing it in his head and the other one's physically doing it out in the world.
Exactly. And those are really different. And if you look at the, you know, if you look at people's life experience, there's a difference in, you know, through that in a very deep way as well. If you look at most people that are magician archetype, or the feminine version of that, which we call media tricks, you know, there tends to be a lack of that warrior principle vis-a-vis assertion, putting themselves out in the world, being goal-oriented, getting things done, asking for what they're worth, you know, the bottom line, that kind of stuff. And on the other hand, of course, the warrior, right, he doesn't necessarily want to listen to what the magician's got to tell him about what's wrong with his ideas and that kind of thing. So, well, everybody's got something to learn from the other side here, but that's the impersonal axis, you know,
well,
on the other side.
Now, over the years, have certain archetypes maybe been more empowered than others, Gary?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, I mean, it's pretty clear with the shift from the 50s to the 60s, right? The 50s, the mother-father archetype are clearly running the show. You know, you got Father Knows Best on TV. You've got, you know, the family unit being very much intact. And then the 60s really comes along and questions the mother-father and the warrior. And that's a worldwide movement, particularly expressed in the U.S., but, you know, a questioning of the warrior and the mother-father and, you know, a rise in sort of what you call the lover, what we call the seeker-companion, comes up through that time and into the 70s until the 80s when you get, you know, the reverse flip. And, of course, we're back to the warrior and the father and all that. And I think with you know, with devastating consequences that we're feeling today, right?
Speak to that a little bit, if you can, kind of quickly, you know, how it's affecting us today.
Right. Well, you know, I think very clearly our society is very, you know, warrior dominated. If you go into a corporate boardroom, it's going to be all, you know, father warriors or mother Amazons in our language. And those people are, you know, very comfortable with hierarchy. You mentioned hierarchy at the opening. They're very comfortable with, you know, top-down situations. And, you know, achieving on the warrior side, it's about achieving and, you know, what have you done for me this quarter and all that sort of short-term stuff. And it's a license to a very, you know, the warrior can be a license to a very mercenary approach to reality. And, you know, father warrior or the mother Amazon can be a very, you know, principled, mature leader in the community and be wonderful. And a lot of the leaders and, you know, a lot of great, you know, social movements, I'm sure, were father warrior and mother Amazon. But what we see today, of course, is a lot of that archetype, particularly in corporate boardrooms and all that, you know, running the world more or less. You know,
it seems
really
ruthless to me.
Yeah, that's the dark side of the warrior is no connection to, you know, the outcomes of what really happens from their goal achieving. So.
Well, you know, this seems like this might be a segue to what we were sort of chatting about before we actually went on the air, Gary. Could one of you address sort of the archetypes at play in, say, conservatives versus liberals?
Yeah, well, very clearly there's a split, and it's right across the middle of our archetypal work. On the right hand, you've got father warriors, mother Amazons, holding a very sort of old social principles on the right. So you've got the mother and father that are, you know, speaking to old values, you know, old ways of being. We've got to go back to the way things were, all that kind of stuff. And then the warrior Amazon piece, which is about, you know, basically every man for a man or woman for himself,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the right wing. And on the left wing, you've got the magician archetype, people coming up with great ideas, the Al Gores and that kind of thing. But then also the child archetype in terms of, you know, what we see as a secret companion archetype, that opposing principle to the father warrior or the mother Amazon is the secret magician, that quadrant there in our system. And, you know, obviously there's so much brilliance and, you know, we have all the ideas that we need to save the planet and all these other things, but we don't have the political achievement to actually really do as much as what we'd like to do to get those goals accomplished. And for me, as someone who's been watching the political world for a long time with this archetypal model, you know, I see the right wing and the father warrior doing a great job of winning a political contest.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they really understand that, you know, it is a fight. It is a, you know, it's a war for every single voter. And, you know, the left sort of shows up with great ideas and expects everyone, you know, everyone to just say, oh, wow, that's the, you know, great idea. Let's do that. And they don't really understand that it's a, you know, it's a fight for every single vote. And, you know, what I'm seeing go on in the Green Movement now is a recognition of that. And there's some literature coming out now in the environmental movement about, you know, we've got to speak to other voters. We've got to speak to other constituencies. You know, they're more or less saying we've got this archetypal, you know, we've got this archetypal group that gets us and that's down with us, but we can't, you know, we don't have the mass we need politically to actually go forward into, you know, get these things done. And you have to speak a different language if you want to, you know, if you want to speak to the voters on the right, you've got to give them something that speaks to them archetypally, which is going to be more father warrior or mother Amazon to a certain extent.
So what you're saying is, you know, like, I mean, I'm obviously on the left, and I've been very frustrated because it feels like I think Anthony Weiner said it best, you know, we go into fights with Republicans with books, and they go into fights with knives. So it's sort of an innate characteristic of the left not to be this sort of cutthroat bully, you know, scrapping in the ditch kind of a thing. That's just not how we're made.
Absolutely. And my line with that is from Untouchables, and it's, you know, the Democrats like to bring a knife to a gunfight, which is basically the same thing. You know, it's you know, and Al Gore said that himself, basically. And well, in 2000, Al Gore was running, in, you know, for president, and said, you know, he said, "Oh, it's not a popularity contest." And I went, you know, what do you think it is? You know,
right?
I mean, that's exactly what an election is. And if you look at all a lot, let me give you a list of names: Gore, Mondale, Dukakis. I mean, these are not father archetype fellas, and they're not bringing enough warrior. And the Democrats seem to, over and over and over again, pick these fellas that have no warrior component to them, and they're unsuccessful, and they don't kind of learn that, you know, you need someone in there who's got some innate, you know, a level of warrior. And I do see that, for example, in Clinton and Kennedy, you know, mm-hmm. and you know, they've got enough fight that people, you know, they won,
mm-hmm.
You know, but they've got that, you know, warrior in them that comes across the political divide and tends to work for them at least for a little while. So, yeah,
well,
I mean,
you're making me think of Bill Moore. He was talking about how he wished Obama had a little bit of George Bush in him, and he meant that, you know, he doesn't see much warrior in George Bush. You know, I'm sorry, in Obama, but yet George Bush had too much warrior. You know,
exactly.
Right. Well,
yeah,
so where does Sarah Palin fit into this? Is she just, you know, falls onto the right-wing side, or is there more to her?
She's a perfect classic example of what we call the Mother Amazon, you know, the Mama Grizzly.
And what about Hillary Clinton? Is she the same?
You know, it's tough to say. I mean, I think with someone like Hillary, you know, I certainly feel like there's some scrapper there. You know, there's some warrior. You know, archetypally, she does feel a little bit more magician or media tricks, someone more knowledge-based and ideas-based.
Okay.
Karen, I can add that one of the other things I think that's happening that's sort of causing our political structure on the right to be so insensitive to the needs of the people is that I think there's been a real loss in the father archetype itself. I think in the 50s, when you had father warrior, father really was taking care of his own. He was generative. He wanted his country, his people to thrive. And I think what we've got in the last 20 years with the right is that the father is either missing and you've got, you know, all warrior, which I think is what's taken down our financial structure. But the lack of the personal axis, one of the things we talk about in the workshop is that when you have an impersonal axis, either warrior or magician, that the personal axis humanizes the way in which you are relating to the world. And
mm-hmm.
if you have a personal axis, the impersonal axis stabilizes you in the world. And I think there has really been an absence on the right, how they're defining father, how they're connecting to it. I think it's getting very over-identified with its power. We were talking
mm-hmm.
about that, you know, the idea that father can want to have power over others. And in some cases, I think it's just been absent altogether, and it's really been driven by the warrior.
Well, they're devoid of any sort of social justice or, you know, it's all just sort of ruthlessness, it seems like. You know, if you haven't achieved what they think you should have achieved, well, then to hell with you. You know, go eat cat food and live under a bridge, you know.
Right, exactly. And, you know, the 50s, even Eisenhower, no one's going to say that Eisenhower didn't have, you know, a lot of warrior archetype going on there. But he also did have the father, and he left office telling us, you know, watch out for the military-industrial complex. And, I mean, can anyone imagine George Bush saying that? I mean, you know, it's exactly like Katie says, you know, that we've got a pure warrior philosophy now on the right, with only using the father in order to start a little culture war fire or to do a little race baiting or play on the worst fears, the lowest common denominator of voters from a father or mother archetype, old values point of view.
Right. Well, and, you know, and some would say, well, gee, these are supposed to be the Christians. The Christians are supposed to be the ones, you know, they're Jesus-like and love one another. But I think they're really more the Yahweh Christians than the Jesus Christians.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, it's a very, you know, and it's, yeah, I mean, they're with the Father and not with the Son. I mean, that's pretty clear. I mean, you know, There's a study I read that's more than half of American Christians believe that you know, the Lord helps those who help themselves is in the Bible.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Is there you know, a statement that's more anti-Christian than that? I mean,
exactly. Yeah, the hypocrisy is staggering. Well, KD and Bob, we probably have about 5 minutes left, and I want to make sure we talk about your workshops. And if there's any piece of this we've missed, like, for instance, I do have a quick question. I hate to let you go without asking you this. You dangled a carrot at that workshop that I really wanted an answer to. I'm wondering, you know, the feminist activist, where does she fit into this? Because you thought, I think you said something about, well, it's not quite so obvious. Is there something sort of perplexing about the archetype of the feminist activist?
Well, I think, you know, any mature figure is going to have access to, you know, all the archetypes. Just because we live in one or two, say, you know, for those of us on the left that live, a lot of people on the left are going to live more in the magician and what we'd call the seeker or companion, the child archetypes. That doesn't mean that we can't have that fight that an activist is going to bring. I know a lot of people that, you know, work in environmental and other movements, you know, and they use their warrior, but they don't live there. And that's a definition. Just because, you know, we live in these some other archetypes doesn't mean we can't have access to that warrior piece that wants to go out and fight for what's right.
Gotcha. Makes perfect sense. Well, now, there's a lot of things we didn't get to cover, but I'm sure you probably cover it in your workshop, you know, how people can identify the archetype in other people, and, you know, a lot of different stuff like that. So why don't you talk a little bit about your workshops before I have to get on to the next guest?
Sure. Well, the website is yourmyth.com, YOURMYTH.com, yourmyth.com. And we also have a facebook.com/yourmyth. And workshops coming up, we're in Pasadena April 16th and 17th, and Simi Valley April 30th and May 1st. And all the dates are on the website, but we're also going in May to Topanga and Santa Barbara, and then Ashland, Oregon in June, and Vancouver, BC in June. And again, it's yourmyth.com. And we're doing a free talk at the Glen Ivy Spa April 7th, that's in Corona, and at the Joseph Campbell Roundtable in Topanga, April 23rd.
Okay. So maybe would it be a good way to close by saying what's most valuable about having an archetypal understanding of the world?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, it's owning your own strength. I mean, just claiming a piece of turf that's your own and identifying who you are and owning that ground. And that's very powerful. I mean, if you don't own who you are, then, you know, you can't, you know, go out in the world with consciousness and ask for what you need. I think, too, you know, letting go of baggage of other stories that you have about yourself, like the companion mother, you know, letting go of the mother archetype a little bit and just saying it's okay to be herself. And I think, you know, understanding others and just forgiving other people. And, you know, if you have a brother who's a father archetype and he's coming at the world from a different place than you are, it's certainly easier to understand and forgive and have a different perspective on someone if you understand that they're coming from a different archetypal place. You know, and the workshops are very, you know, both deep. We talk about how these stories are eternal, you know, and very practical, too. I mean, a lot of it's really, you know, stuff we've seen on a day-to-day basis for a long time, and it really helps people, you know, see the world with more compassion and more understanding. And you know, if you can own your own story, you can keep it from owning you unconsciously. And a lot of people, you know, are living a story unconsciously. And I think, you know, this is a way to go back to a deeper view of the world around us.
So when you say, you know, we're not really living our story, we sort of get, well, again, you know, I guess going full circle back to the beginning, you know, if we don't use critical thinking, self-analysis, we sort of get maybe caught up in these groups, and we sort of just, it becomes groupthink, you know, and we sort of just go with kind of like a Borg mentality. I mean, is that maybe a good description?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think exactly. I mean, you know, a lot of people are living in a little subculture or in the dominant culture and just sort of following along with, you know, what's expected of them from that point of view. And I think it's really powerful just to claim an archetypal identity that transcends culture and can really help you identify who are you.
Who are you? Who are the people around you? Yeah. Well, you know, it would really be interesting if we could do this when we vote. You know, we could look at the politicians out there and look at them in terms of archetype, although we'd never really know if we're seeing their authentic self or not, though, would we?
Well, I mean, I think once you've got a good familiarity with archetype, it's pretty easy to see what's going on with the politicians and where they're coming from archetypally. And, you know, it's pretty hard to get the wool pulled over your eyes.
Well,
rather
you know what?
Obvious, in other words.
What, KD?
I said it gets rather obvious once you get a few of the basics down to see what's happening politically.
I can just imagine you two sitting on the sofa watching TV, watching Fox News, and just naming everybody.
Yeah, well, that's not a tough one.
It's a bit like counting sheep. It's just how many of everybody's on that station.
Well, you know what? I wish President Obama would hire you, and maybe, you know, he'll find some of his his warrior. Because I'm not sure he understands the other side enough to go into that fight with the knife and not the book.
Yeah, well, we'll see. You know, hopefully you're all right, and he's a pretty smart guy, so maybe he'll learn something in the next little while.
Well, we can only hope. Well, listen, you two, it's been great. KD, Gary, thank you so much. It's been really interesting. And I am going to make it to one of those workshops. I find this stuff so intriguing, and I really like how once you start to get a hang of this, you can identify other people, you can identify yourselves. And, you know, and I really get it, that once you have that understanding, you know, instead of butting heads with that authoritarian father, you can sort of, you know, maybe understand him and not make it so tense at the Thanksgiving dinner table or something.
Yeah, and you can understand what they're looking for from you and what they need from you just to feel comfortable. And, you know, when you can meet other people's needs, it's just a lot easier.
Right. Well, listen, thank you so much. Good luck with your workshops, and I hope to see you both soon.
Thank you very much, Karen.
Thank you, Karen.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. Well, if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss goddess, the divine feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking. Some call it the feminine consciousness. I call her the great she, because you know what? She's everything. She can be deity, archetype, or ideal. And we talk about here how these new values and benchmarks just will save the world. We're not going to say might anymore. We're going to say will save the world. And you've been listening to K.D. Farris and Gary Bobroff teaching us about archetypes and how this knowledge can enhance our lives, ourselves, and our understanding of others. Well, it's that time when we're crossing the threshold into the next part of the show, when I take just a brief one-minute music break to get ready for my next guest, who is Crystal Blanton. And our topic is very important. Trust me, I know the topic is responsible priestessing. So please stay tuned with me because I am going to leave for just one little minute here. And while I leave you to get ready for Crystal, how about I let you listen to Choose Love by Laura Kane.
I say I will. I take the ride. 'Cause I'd rather have connection, pleasure, and pain than be alone here with my pride. Okay, I'll take my shot. This time I'll take my chance. 'Cause that's all I have left. If I don't, if I won't choose love, and pride's all I have left. If I don't choose love. Thank you.
thank you, listeners, for staying with me. See, I told you it would only be a minute, and it was. Thank you for staying tuned in with us here at Voices of the Sacred Feminine. I am going to unmute Crystal. Hey, Crystal, can you hear me? Not yet. Hey, Crystal, can you hear me now?
I sure can.
Great, great. Thank you so much for being on the show and suggesting this great topic, responsible priestessing.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm quite excited to be on here tonight.
Well, good. Well, you know what? Let me start by just telling listeners a little bit about you, and then we'll sort of jump in and start chatting about responsible priestessing. Listeners, Crystal is a trained and experienced registered addiction specialist in the field of drug and alcohol counseling, which enhances her understanding of spiritual balance and how behavior and perceptions affect our everyday lives. Her book, Bridging the Gap, Working Within the Dynamics of Pagan Groups and Society, was published in the fall of last year, brand new book. Crystal is a high priestess and an ordained minister with Covenant of the Goddess, or COG, and also Dance of the Spirit Moon tradition, and she's a student mentor. She lives in the San Francisco Bay Area with her husband and children, and she tries to read as much as possible. Crystal, I don't know if you're like me, but man, it is sure hard to find time to just read a trashy novel, isn't it?
Yes, it is, and you know, I make it part of my practice that every night before I go to bed, I read some. So I try to alternate between more spiritual books and then my just total trashy vampire-y type novels that, you know, kind of feed my soul in different ways.
Well, you know, that I would imagine probably comes under priestess self-care, wouldn't you say?
I absolutely do. And, you know, sometimes I need that moment. It's, in many ways, it's almost like taking a meditation break for me because I get to just kind of disconnect from the world and just, you know, be somewhere else for that moment and suspended time and just enjoy something totally different.
Right, right. No, I know what you mean, because so often we're so busy giving, doing. It's so easy to really neglect ourselves.
Yes, and I think that, you know, as a priestess, you know, it's not something that is talked about enough. I think we're going that route where we're talking more about how do you take care of yourself and the importance of taking care of yourself and how that directly feeds into the service that you're giving to the goddess and the service that you're giving to those that you are trying to support. But it's
not—it's
definitely not in the forefront of training right now for priestesses.
Right.
You know, really take self-care as a priority.
Well, you know, the analogy I always think of when we're talking about self-care, because I know I'm the type of person I tend to, you know, give, and I have to, you know, set healthy boundaries. But I always think about that idea of you're in the airplane and the oxygen mask comes down, and you have to put the mask on yourself first before you put it on your loved one, you know. And I think that's a perfect example that we can't neglect ourselves.
It absolutely is, and I think it goes against our nature to take care of ourselves first before we're taking care of someone else. And we think about it, we talk about it sometimes, but even on the airplane, even when they say that, you think, oh, yeah, okay, I'll do that. And in your head, you're going, no, I won't. I'll take that mask down. I'll give it to my kid or to my neighbor first, and then I'll take a breath. And it's hard to really wrap our minds around how important our, you know, keeping ourselves in a secure place is and allows us to actually support the people we're really trying to support.
Right, right. Well, you know, getting to the topic, responsible priestessing, I mean, it really appealed to me because, you know, growing up in the goddess community, you know, over the last 20, 25 years, I didn't see enough of it. Let's put it that way, you know. And I've always felt like at some point if pagans or goddess advocates, whatever we're going to call ourselves, Wiccans, I mean, I know we all call ourselves different things. You know, we're a big umbrella. You know, if we're really ever going to, I think, get serious about I don't know, being an organized movement, being influential, and I think that's important because I believe, our ideals or the ideals that can potentially, you know, help the planet become sustainable. You know, it just feels like we have to do a lot of education, maybe in our own communities, because, you know, the standards are just all over the place. You know, a lot of places don't teach ethics. You know, a lot of places, well, yeah, you'll maybe find out how to, you know, do a spell, but you won't find out about, doing a bad spell versus a good spell kind of a thing. Did you want to talk about this for the same reason? You know, why did you recommend to me responsible priesting as our priestessing as our show topic?
I think it's probably one of the most important conversations that we as a community can have. There's several of them, and this is definitely one of them. I think part of what pushed me to write about, you know, just leadership in general and the topics that I write about is my own experiences in finding the priestesses that weren't able to really priestess in the way that I needed it to happen. And I've been working in the social services field for about 14, 15 years now, and it's so funny how when I came into trying to find somebody to mentor me or to priestess me, trying to learn how I suspended my own knowledge and it really kind of put my own power in the hands of someone else, and that person misused that. And it makes it so, it was a very important part of my path, I might add. You know, it had to happen the way that it happened. But when I came to myself a year or so later, I really sat back and thought, how did I let this happen? I know this stuff. I know how to work with dynamics. I know how to, all this is what I do in my professional life. And yet there's, you know, there's such a lack of accountability in our community for holding priests and priestesses accountable for what they're doing with their students and how they're priestessing. And there's also a lack of training for, mm-hmm. you know, people to learn the skills that are needed to have healthy, productive engagements with those who are students or with community members or all those things. And so it's just the makings of the things that could destroy our community as opposed to sustain it. And I really want to be a part of helping us learn to sustain our community. I was really empowered to write about this because I had such an awakening experience as a result of some things that I went through.
Well, you know, I think we're saying the same thing, but I feel like there almost needs to be some sort of standardized teaching. So that we raise the bar in some cases, and so that pagans, goddess advocates, you know, across the board are kind of hearing the same things, and you know, maybe going by the same rules. Are you saying that too?
You know, in some ways, I think that would be very helpful. It's hard in a community like ours because our beliefs vary so much from one, you know, section to the next.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that also adds the complication of the fact that we have no means to hold priestesses accountable for
right.
having accurate leadership skills or for training even.
Right.
From tradition to tradition, or, you know, it could be completely different. It would be a hard sell in our community to have some kind of central training around priestess skills. And so I'm not exactly sure how that would look, but I do think that no matter what tradition you are in, there are some things, some training, some skills that are being used in the professional world. Of counseling and in many different ways in the world that need to be integrated into our expectations of
mm-hmm.
what priests and priestesses are able to do with the people that they're working with and in the community.
Well, and also some accountability for ones that behave badly, I think, too.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, I know I've seen in communities where sometimes, you know, a person just gets away with murder and, you know, no one ever holds the person accountable, you know, and it really sort of gives a bad name to the whole group in a sense. But I'm sure this is no different than any other group. You know, we're probably talking about problems that exist in, you know, Christianity, Scientology, whatever we're talking about, you know.
I agree, and I think because it's a human issue, and so mm-hmm. no matter what particular arena we're talking about, that every type of faith, every type of subset of or culture has their concerns that they need to work out.
Right.
But I think the difference is that we don't have anybody to go to. There's no central or common way that we can all go and discuss the things that are happening that are not okay within our community. There's no
right.
way to hold somebody accountable. And that
right,
and that's
right.
a problem. And unfortunately, priestesses and priests out there that are not necessarily doing it for the right reasons or doing things that are unethical, there's no way to hold them accountable, and they continue to go around it and reoffend to other people.
Exactly. Now, you know, you wanted to talk a little bit about knowledge that's not necessarily in pagan books that you think is important, and I totally agree with you, counseling, conflict mediation. Talk about those things that you think, you know, ought to be part of the responsible priestess's repertoire.
Absolutely. You know, there are so many situations where the covens are destroyed, groups are destroyed, witch wars are created, and there are methods to deal with conflict mediation or learning how to communicate effectively that we don't necessarily harness in our community. And outside of our community, it's very much becoming a part of regular interactions. And I think that we need to kind of integrate some of those models into the way that we're able to deal with things. We're able to identify problems before they actually happen. We're able to deal with things as they're coming to try and diffuse what's happening so that we don't keep getting into these situations where groups and covens have shelf lives of 2 years or less, and then we can't understand why we're not able to sustain community.
Mm-hmm.
So there's lots of things like, for example, like restorative justice that's being used not only in the justice system but also in schools now and in some agencies and companies, organizations that are helping people learn how to build senses of, you know, a sense of community, learning how to create community, effective community, and learning how to effectively deal with conflict as it comes up so that you're able to restore relationships as they are, you know, as they're broken throughout the process of just interacting with each other. And
right.
those types of skills, I think, could be very helpful in a group situation or a priestessing situation when we're dealing with people and there's going to be conflict. There's going to be different types of situations that come up, and we're just not equipped to deal with them.
Let me ask you something, and this is a little bit off the subject, but I think maybe this is something you can at least give an opinion. You know, I've heard people say to me, you know what, healthier groups, you know, where there's less fighting, are usually groups where there's men and women and not just women. Has that been your experience too, or do you think it's just very random, dependent from group to group?
Yeah, I think that that's too simplified to mm-hmm. make an assumption of that sort. I think there's a lot of variables that come to group conflict. I think that the nature of the conflicts may be different or the tension may be different, but I have not found that it is, you know, women-only groups have more dissension inside of a group than mixed race or mixed sex kind of groups. I think it depends. And the, mm-hmm. and the nature, you know, I've seen groups that have men and women in it that are have horrific circumstances come up that split groups apart, and I've also seen it in women-only groups.
Yeah. Well, now, also managing dynamics, you think that's an important part of being a responsible priestess. Talk a little bit mm-hmm. about that.
Absolutely. You know, part of our training across the board, for the most part, within our communities really revolves around magic and how to be this great ritualist, how to work with energy on the universe kind of level. But we don't really talk about how to deal with the energies that are within, you know, our own groups. We don't necessarily train on how to deal with, you know, keeping a healthy group dynamic. And oftentimes I've ran into priestesses and priests that don't even understand or have a real concept of what a group mind really is. And if we don't understand that, then we don't really understand how to keep it healthy. And so I think that learning how or having tools on how to deal with building healthy group dynamics and maintaining healthy group dynamics is extremely important. And so often we jump into groups and we kind of throw them together, or we join a group and we just, you know, we think that the commonality of our love of the goddess or our worshiping beliefs is enough to sustain it, and it's not. You know, there is a human element in everything that we bring because we are humans. And so if we're not equipped on how to really deal with that and manage that, you know, it comes to, you know, that year and a half to 2 year kind of break for many groups and covens where the human issues become so overwhelming that it takes away from the spiritual aspect of being able to grow together and worship together as a group. And
yeah.
That's when we see groups dissolve and witch wars start and conflicts and, you know, misunderstandings and miscommunications turn into these huge community issues that are not resolvable in that moment.
Right, right. You know, talk a little bit about, you know, the demands of balancing the job of being a responsible priestess and, you know, just sort of living in the everyday mundane world.
The demands are incredible. For those of us who are out there and priestessing and attempting to really have an impact in the community, we know that, you know, the demands on our time and our energy are huge. And when you put in a real clear system of ethics and training and trying to really be the most professional and well-equipped priestess, it adds another burden onto your plate. But I also think the rewards for that are very great. We get to really be a part of sustaining community in ways that the pagan community hasn't yet perfected. I think we're getting better, but we're not there yet. So, you know, the demands on that are really high because there are a lot of times, a lot of situations where, you know, several people may be the priestesses in the crowd that think one way or deal with it one way, and it's not a universal kind of thing. And that creates complications in and of itself. I think one of the most important things that we don't think about enough or talk about enough is preparing ourselves to be priests or priestesses in the community, preparing ourselves to be the most trained and skilled person that we can be for the goddess. And that starts internally and understanding the work that needs to be done internally. And I'm still doing my work. And if there's a priestess out there that says they've done it all, they've done all the work, I would question that. So, you know, it's a continuous, you know what I mean? It's a continuous learning experience, and I know I've got a lot to learn, and I'm on my path, but I'm grateful
right.
to be on my path. So.
Well, yeah, like I always say, you know, we're lucky to know the questions to ask. We certainly don't have all the answers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you know, I think oftentimes when covens or groups form, I'm not sure how many people actually even stop to think about the responsibilities of being a priestess in a community. I mean, what do you think or some of those job descriptions are?
You know what? I think there's a couple of things. I think that in my book, there's a chapter that I refer to Instagroups. And Instagroups for me are the ones that we, you know, you have a couple of friends and you circle together and you have so much fun and you have things in common and then you just decide to kind of put a name behind it and form a group. And the ways to really deal with that and the best ways to deal with that. And so, you know, talking about the kinds of roles that are needed, the kinds of the organization, the coming up with, you know, norms and values and common understandings of expectation for one another. Those kinds of things play really key parts in any kind of group, especially in an Insta group, where you're not walking into a group that already has a foundation. You're creating something. And I think that oftentimes the roles in groups mimic that of a family. And I think that's one of the things that creates the extra element of confusion or complication, actually. You know, you'll have the person that's the very motherly person. You'll have the person that, you know, to hold people accountable to the rules. You'll have the person that's really out there trying to, you know, keep the polish on the group and keep everything looking one way. You'll have the person that's the jokester that tries to support everybody in having fun and staying connected that way, very much like a large family and the roles inside of a group that's very much like a family. And so, you know, what makes that complicated, I talk a little bit about this in my book, what makes that even more complicated is the fact that oftentimes the roles that people play in their own nuclear family then translates over into a coven family type dynamic.
And they bring their baggage with them too, whether that baggage be good or bad.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, we say that in counseling all the time, wherever you go, there you are. So, you know, if I'm this person and I'm dealing with these things in my life, when I show up to circle, I'm still the same person. And if I don't find ways to work through those things that I'm going through or to identify those things even, some people haven't even identified the fact that they're going through, that there's some stuff that they need to work on, then that's what I'm bringing.
Mm-hmm.
And that energy becomes a part of the energy of the group mind. And that goes back to what we were talking about earlier. You know, priests and priestesses really understanding, you know, the group mind isn't just happening when you're circling together. It's all the energy, it's all the unspoken things, it's all the things that weave together because we're people, we're whole people when we join into an energetic connection. It's not just a piece of us. It's not just my magical piece that joins an energetic connection that creates the group mind. It's, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Yeah, the shadow stuff comes too. Well, you know, I know one of the things that, I mean, actually I have a couple chapters in my book, Walking an Ancient Path, where I talk about politics and I talk about trying to get along. And actually I talk about my disappointment and disillusionment because, you know, I belong to a really big, you know, Dyanic feminist group. And I don't know, I just, and this may be, it had been, you know, I went into it thinking, you know what, these women should probably be ahead of the curve. They know about oppression. They know about hierarchy. They know about the patriarchy. You know, they should probably be doing a better job getting along with one another. But you know what? They really weren't. And I found that disheartening. And I guess I wonder if you encounter the very same thing.
Yes, absolutely. And I think we have this kind of, I'll speak for myself. Coming into this community, I had this kind of warped sense of understanding that I'm interacting with spiritual people. So, of course, you know, they fit this ideal of what I think a spiritual person is. And I think I took the human element out of the equation, and I didn't think about it. And what I found was that, you know, I can't compartmentalize people that way. And I knew this from being a counselor, but once you step into a spiritual kind of realm, it's almost like those things you know go to one side, and then you have this whole different kind of image of, oh, this is a high priestess, that means that I can trust her instantly. Not true. You know, oh, this is, you know, this person, that means that they know what they're talking about. Not true. And so I had to, like a lot of us have to, you know, harness our own power and understand that everybody around us, including ourselves, are learning how to do that. And nobody is completely at that place where they are perfectly where they need to be. And you know, everybody's on the growth kind of, you know, road. We're all growing. And some people are more authentic in their growth than others. And so it makes it really hard when you are in a group that you assume all of us do assume that they are more of an enlightened path. They're where we're trying to be, you know, all these things. And then we have this realization like, wow, you know, they're still humans. They're just in a spiritual group.
Right, right, exactly.
And that's a hard realization at times.
Well, and, you know, and I have to admit there were times where I felt the spirituality was very lacking, you know. It didn't feel like that Kuan Yin energy,
mm-hmm,
you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was much more kind of, I don't know. but you know, it was like the schoolyard or something, as opposed to, a spiritual priestess community, you know. And I just wished it could be different. But like you said, the skill sets just aren't there. You know, some people who start these groups, maybe don't start them with enough background to avoid some of these pitfalls, I guess.
Absolutely. And, you know, I talk a lot about, when I'm doing workshops or writing, I talk a lot about my concept of raising priests and priestesses. And that's what we're doing. We're raising the next set of, when we're mentoring, we're raising the next set of priests and priestesses. And it's important for us to look at that, like, if we don't first have the skills we need, and in turn don't support those who are coming into the community in learning the skills that they need to not only be able to integrate into the community and do it in healthy ways, but to also deal with their own stuff, to deal with their own stuff and learn how to support others in moving that energy, working with the shadow side, doing all that internal, emotional, icky stuff that needs to be moved, then all we're doing is teaching people how to be really good ritualists. And that's
mm-hmm.
really awesome for magic work, but that does not sustain a community or a group.
Well,
that just means
also,
we have equally harmed and in many ways dysfunctional. We're all, you know, many of us come into the ritual circle that way, people who now just know how to do a really, really great ritual.
Right. And you know what, that's a really good point, because, I have been involved with that sort of thing. People who could do a really great ritual, but the personal skill sets were really not there. And you know what, and I think that problem bleeds into the ritual, you know, in a way. You know, it bleeds into the energetics if there's disharmony in the group. And, I mean, I the idea of perfect love and trust, you know, in some communities, it's really sort of just a joke, you know. You get together and you maybe do an awesome ritual, but, you know, it's the stuff that's under the surface that, you know, you have to wonder if it doesn't sort of seep out, you know, into even the magical work.
Of course it does. It absolutely does, because, again, we come together and we're whole people. So in order for us to even have our magic manifest in the way that we want it to, we have to be able to focus our intention and pull all that energy towards that point that we are helping make manifest. And if I'm holding back some of my intention with the fact that I can't stand that chick over there, but I haven't talked to her about it, and ooh, look at her, she don't even look right, whatever's going on in the dysfunction of a group because people aren't on the same accord, and you don't have that perfect love and perfect trust, then, you know, everybody's not able to put they're, you know, 100% in. They can't even put 90% in. They're
right.
holding some of that back that's tied up in the dynamics that are unhealthy.
Right,
and so,
right.
you know, it doesn't, you know, oftentimes I know I've been in groups that do this, and I've been the person that's tried this myself. It's tried to ignore the issues or ignore what you think might be coming your way in a group or coven, hoping that it'll go away and we don't have to talk about it and everybody will be great again. It doesn't happen that way. And if
mm-hmm.
we don't learn how to engage in this stuff and give people the forum to learn how to work out the weird stuff, the icky stuff that happens in any group, not just in pagan groups, in any group, because we're people,
mm-hmm.
if we don't learn how to do that, then we just sit with it. And that's
right.
not something I want to put into my energy work, for sure. I know that. You know, if I need something back that's going to help protect me or support me or putting some healing energy out to the earth or stuff, I want it to be pure and powerful. I don't want a little bit of gray yuckiness going with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, what do you think are some of the common pitfalls of priestessing in our community?
There's a bunch of them. And I think that some of the ones that I talk about the most are around ineffective communication skills. I think that's a huge one in our community, and not knowing how to address things that come up, good or bad. I think the inability to confront issues, the wanting to kind of push them off and see them kind of, I don't know, go away or come back differently so that we don't have to deal with it. Boundaries are huge. And I think, you know, it's really hard to keep boundaries in some situations. And it's really, and some of us don't even know what our boundaries are. We don't even know we have that boundary until it was crossed and it doesn't feel right. And then without the skills to communicate that to, you know, in the situation, then it just becomes even worse. It just compounds on top of it, on top of that. I think, you know, one of the things with mentors who are raising priests and priestesses, I think one of the hard things is recognizing or acknowledging the fact that a dynamic isn't working, being the bad guy and saying that this isn't going to work. You know, it's a hard thing to do. And oftentimes I think in our community, because it's small, because we're growing, a lot of times friends are mentoring friends, or, you know, people who have history are mentoring each other, and it's hard to say that that's not working, that's not right, or, you know, to really kind of put boundaries down. It makes it complicated, and in turn we compromise. And that's not necessarily the best way all the time, depending on the situation, on how to deal with it.
Right.
I think dealing with anger in groups is a huge pitfall, and that people don't know how to deal with that. We don't know how to deal with anger. And
if I could interject here, jealousy also.
that's
a big one.
Yes, jealousy. I was going to add another
competition.
To that. Gossip.
Yes,
that seems to be a really hard one for many of us, myself included, and you know, knowing how to deal with it as it comes. You know, knowing what to say and what not to say. Knowing how not to triangulate the situations when there are concerns. You know, all of those things are huge. They're huge in our community.
Yeah, I mean, they can be the cause of, you know, witch wars and covens, you know, splitting up. I just wish there were a way to... you know, again, maybe I'm going back to standards, but, you know, sometimes I've been in groups and I felt like, gee, everybody knows what the rule book is but me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, you know, I feel like I'm walking through a minefield and I just blew off my foot, but nobody told me that I was walking through a minefield, you know, kind of a thing. You know, it's really hard sometimes to find your way when there's maybe cliques within the groups and there's hierarchy within the groups and you know, you got, I don't know whether you're familiar with this term, but I grew up in a group that had the big P's, which were supposedly the real priestesses, and then the little P's, you know, the ones that weren't really priestesses. We let them, you know, collect money at the door or handle the food table, but they never really got to do anything in a public ritual. You know, there were all of these, you know, all of these different stratas, and, you know, that doesn't make for a healthy community, you know?
Right, and it doesn't. And I think, you know, one of the parts I talk about in the chapter around the common pitfalls of groups in the book is a part of when we're talking about perception. And I call it, you know, do you see what I see? And the assumptions that we make that everybody understands the structures that are in place, or everybody's on the same page. It makes sense to everyone. And that's one of the things that gets us in trouble, because it doesn't. And the... like you were mentioning, the big P's and the little P's, you know, the big P's may understand why that is the way it is, and in turn have a hard time relating to, you know, what may come up for the little P's, and understanding that their perception is going to be much different. And unless there is a lot of communication around it and a lot of buy-in and support and openness around what the process is, it could be the makings of some really big misunderstandings and hurt feelings.
Right.
So, you know, really, those are some of those things.
Well, really what you're saying is this is a lot of work, you know, because not only are you trying to lead a community or a coven or a group in magic, you're also trying to teach, you know, because you probably do classes. You know, you're trying to be on your own spiritual path at the same time, maybe mentoring others. I mean, it's almost like growing a family, you know? I mean, it takes a lot of time and effort and skill, and I don't think most people really stop and think, if you got a good priestess, man, you have something really valuable.
I 100% agree. And that's the fine print on the I'm about to do my degree study contract that most of us don't read. And it's like it's not about the like, ooh, I'm a high priestess. There's so much responsibility that's not understood in taking that journey. And I think a lot of times it's not understood because the people who are training don't understand it themselves. Or if they understand it, they're not really sure how to teach that or share that. And I don't know, honestly, if I would have some of the skills and understanding of some of these things that I do if I wasn't a counselor.
I
did not learn it in the pagan path. I learned it in my professional world. And it became very clear how much those two things were really one and the same. Because when I'm sitting in a counseling group, facilitating a treatment or therapy group, I have to be very mindful of the negativity that's in the group. I have to be very mindful of the different places that everybody is in their journey towards recovery or whatever the issue is that we're talking about. I have to keep my eye on the negativity. And if that comes up, you know, negativity breeds negativity. So if I'm in a counseling group, I've got to learn how to diffuse that. I have to know how to diffuse that so that the rest of those group members don't fall down that trap. These are all things that counselors and professional people are trained to be able to do. And then I look at us in the pagan community, and I'm like, wow, it's exactly the same, except we don't know how to do that.
Yeah, it really points to how ill-equipped we are. And it's a shame, too, because, you know, I think we have so many of the answers, you know, our ecofeminism, you know, our goddess values. And, you know, if we could just get ourselves together, we could be an awesome, I think, an awesome, you know, force and influence to make the world a better place. Well, you know, talk a little bit about priestess self-care. And you know, probably it feels like I should say, you know what, whether you're a priestess or not, you know, I mean, I think this applies.
It absolutely applies. And I want to go back for one second and just say that I agreed with everything you said. I think that it's so important that we acknowledge the incredible talent we have in this community and that we're all growing and that the pagan community as a whole is growing to the next level. So we may not have the collective skills yet, but that's why it's so important now. We're growing to the next level so we can up our game even more and give back even more in ways that make us even healthier and sustainable as a community. So I just want to acknowledge the fact that we have some incredible people out there and some people that I very much, you know, tip my hat to and am in awe of working with. And, you know, we need to extend that out so we can grow even more as a community.
Clone those people. I just want to give you a heads up on time, Crystal.
Okay.
We have like about 15 minutes, and I want to get to the priestess self-care, the high priestess diva complex, and, you know, the boundaries. So,
absolutely. Okay, so priestess self-care. Again, it's just like, you know, for me in my world, being a mom. You know, it is a job that never ends. You know, whether I am sleeping in the middle of the night or I'm at work and my phone rings, no matter what, I'm always a mom. And so there has to be some time that I carve out to take care, to replenish those things that help me be the best mom that I can be. Otherwise, I'm just running low all the time and I can't do it. I can't give what I don't have. So it's extremely important in all areas of our life, especially in mothering or priestessing or any of those things, that we are giving back to ourselves so that we can rebuild ourselves while we're giving out Otherwise, we just go dry. And we see that all the time. We see people burn out. We see people, you know, step away from the community because it's gotten too overwhelming or there's too much stress or too much drama. And, you know, these people are fried. And if we don't learn effective ways to take care of ourselves and do self-care, do those things that feel good, that rebuild us energetically, take the days off, you know, have boundaries in place. So, like, unless someone's bleeding, I'm not answering the phone at 2 a.m. to talk to you about grounding. I'm sleeping. You know, these things that, you know, we all have to put these things in place so that we can maintain. If we don't maintain, we cannot give.
Right, right. Makes sense. Well, now, what was the point you wanted to make about managing transference and counter-transference?
Yeah. You know, that's a big deal in the counseling world. It's a
what
big deal that – I'm sorry?
Explain what that means in case someone hasn't heard those terms.
Sure. So transference really is in the counseling world, it's the client's projection onto the counselor or the therapist. It's their projecting a past relationship, some image, something onto the counselor in unhealthy ways. And countertransference would be the opposite way. So me as a counselor or a therapist, I'm working with somebody that, for example, reminds me of my brother. And they remind me so much of my brother in ways that I'm not able to manage it. So I find myself interacting with this person from a place that isn't healthy, that is more from a place of me dealing with my own issues with my brother, whether I have a great relationship with my brother or not. And I'm projecting that onto the client.
So in other words, a coven member might look at the high priestess as their mother and sort of bring along their mother issues to the high priestess.
You got it. That's exactly it.
Okay.
Yes. And oftentimes, you know, because there have been many different situations that people have gone through that have not been great or functional situations with high priests or high priestesses in the past, oftentimes people find that when they join new groups that they're bringing some of that with them and it's being projected onto the new group or the new high priestess or whatnot, you know, issues that they are carrying from previous experiences and encounters. And I experienced something very similar to that. And so, you know, it's something that I think we need to be aware of in the community and it's something that we need to be able to deal with so that we're not just projecting, you know, ill circumstances and putting on different faces to people that are not in that place. It's really us seeing through a lens of our shadow side as opposed to really looking at it for what it is.
So is this sort of like projecting? Is this sort of the same thing as projecting?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, and I think sometimes what happens to high priestesses, too, they sort of become the victim of, and I'm not sure what the right word is, maybe you can tell me, but sometimes people have to demonize the high priestess in order to sort of cut the cord, and they maybe do the same thing with their mother. They demonize the mother in order to be able to go on and, you know, maybe go on with their life or leave the group. Is that a dynamic that comes up very often?
Yes. Yes, very much. And it takes me back to looking at the concept of raising priests and priestesses in a group or coven kind of experience, because as they grow magically, we're also growing, of course, as the mentors, but as they grow within their own power base, it's almost like the stages of development for a child into, you know, their teen years and into their later teens where, you know, those of us who have kids from the 16 to 19-year-old range, you know, they're flexing their energetic muscles and they, you know, they know everything at that age and they don't need parents anymore. And, it's a natural developmental kind of place that teenagers are in. And magically or energetically, when we are in a training mode, that's exactly a parallel process that's happening where somebody's in their third-degree studies, and a lot of us have had this experience or have heard of this experience where people in their third-degree studies really kind of push back as a mentor. It's a natural thing. It's a natural thing. And if we understand that, if we understand development, if we understand what it means and the dynamics and how that shifts, then we're able to effectively be the professional, effectively kind of guide the people that we're training in that moment, so that when it comes time to them getting their third degree, when it comes time to them hiving and creating their own group, there's no tension. It's not weird. They haven't betrayed anybody. They're going through the process they're supposed to go through.
Yeah.
That's how they become priests and priestesses. It's just like how a teenager then becomes an adult. And
yeah, it's
so
not a competition.
We have to learn how to do that better. And part of our inability to in doing that is that we don't understand the process. We're looking at it from a self place. We're not looking at it from a skilled place or a professional place, or it's not a common understanding that we're trained in, so that we can then see it happening with our students.
Right. Well, and I know one thing that, you know, that I've watched happen was, you know, if a high priestess or one of the, you know, more elders, you know, had to sort of bow out, you know, like maybe to write a book or something, you know, some of the other people may have felt, you know, her absence, you know, they equated it with abandonment or something, you know. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I mean, there's really a lot to look for. I mean, I can see where it would really benefit you know, a high priest or priestess to really have the skill set that you have, you know, as a counselor to see these things happening, so it doesn't, like you said, you don't take it to a personal level.
Absolutely. And, you know, I wish I could say that even though I've been a counselor for 15 years, that these things still don't, that they don't bother me. But they do, because I'm human too. I think the only difference is that I may be able to reflect on them differently. I may be able to see them from a different kind of point of view because of my professional training.
Right.
And I think the more we get that information out to the people who are doing this, the better we're going to become at a community of supporting each other through the process of raising a community, growing inside of ourselves and our own power base and making it more sustainable. Otherwise, we just continue to infight and continue to take things personally and you know, create situations that we don't really know how to deal with. And there's some really wonderful people inside the pagan community.
Right.
And we deserve to give ourselves and our community more than what we have right now.
No, I agree. Well, we probably have about 5 minutes left. So what are some of the tips to be a really good, powerful high priestess and be confident without becoming a diva?
I think the first thing I would absolutely say is deal with your own stuff first. And, of course, that's a work in progress, so we'll continue to deal with our own stuff. But, you know, I've met so many people who want to go through the process, be a high priestess and whatnot, and they can't stabilize their own lives, or they don't want to do the work or dig deep to kind of deal with that stuff that they have and that they've shoved in the bag. Deal with your own stuff first. And if you're dealing with your own stuff, then you understand that the work never stops. If the work never stops, then I can't be any better than anybody else. I'm not on any pedestal. I'm working alongside my students. And just like we say in counseling, so often the client teaches us more than I can teach them. And if I'm open to learning that, then I understand we are all in this process together. We may just be all on different floors of the elevator, but we're still in the same building. So I think having that kind of perspective keeps us a little bit humble.
Well, yeah, it was about humble. I was just about to say, you know, and if the high priestess manages to still be mopping up the floor and emptying the trash, and, you know, and if she's busy doing all the things that a high priestess does, it's kind of hard sometimes to find time to be the diva.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So Crystal, as we close off, I think, you know, maybe the best thing to say is there anything important that we've missed that you want to make sure we say before we have to say goodnight?
I just want to say, first of all, thank you for having me on here. I listen to your show. I'm really honored to be on here. And I'm really honored to talk about a topic that I think we really, really need to continue in many, many discussions in the community. And so I also want to say that, you know, my book is available out there. There's lots of resources outside of my book that's available out there. we need to encourage each other to read and to learn and to grow out in counseling tips and in all kinds of things so that we can be the best priestesses we can for one another.
Maybe you should start some workshops.
Yeah, you know, I
like you don't have enough to do, right?
I know. I've done workshops at the past several pantheocons. And I'm hopefully going out to a couple of festivals this year and next year, kind of getting out there and being a part of kind of presenting some of the materials. So it's in the works. We'll see how it kind of manifests.
Well, good. Well, let me say the name of your book again, Bridging the Gap, Working Within the Dynamics of Pagan Groups and Society. So, Crystal, if someone wanted to reach you, what's the best way?
The best way to reach me would be probably to go to my website, which is crystalblanton.com. And on the website, there's also links to like my Facebook page and Twitter. You can also email me at crystal@crystalblanton.com.
Okay. Well, Crystal, thank you so much. I am so glad you contacted me and suggested this show topic because I really do think it's important as well. We really do need to help our community grow into, you know, its next phase. I think that's really an important thing. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Okay. Well, listeners, we probably only have about 2 minutes left. And before I say goodnight, rather than doing a closing prayer, I think I'd like to just remind you of what I talked about at the top of the hour, Dr. Masura Emoto calling on us from all around the world to get together tomorrow at 12 noon, whenever that is in your own time zone, to pray for the water. He's saying that, you know, to focus on the water of Fukushima nuclear plant. And of course, with everything going on there, that's quite a good thing to do. But don't forget the rest of the waters. Our oceans are not in good shape. The Gulf, we don't even know what's going on in the Gulf. It would be nice to bury our head in the sand, but our water and all the the fishes of the sea that depend on that water, we depend on that water. Let's do what we can. You know, use our collective energy, our collective love, our compassion to try to do what we can to help heal the waters because, as Dr. Emoto has proven to us, when we pray over the water, it changes the molecular structure. So at noon tomorrow or whenever you hear this, you know, don't not do it just because you missed tomorrow at 12 o'clock. But if you are listening to me, that's when, you know, the group collective is going to do this prayer, March 31st, 12 noon, whatever your time zone is. So say aloud or in your mind three times with your hands together in a prayer position in a sincere and compassionate, you know, energy. Just say to the water, water of the Fukushima nuclear plant, we are sorry to make you suffer. Please forgive us. We thank you and we love you. Say that three times. The water of Fukushima nuclear plant, we are sorry to make you suffer. Please forgive us. We thank you and we love you. And one more time, the water of Fukushima nuclear plant, we are sorry to make you suffer. Please forgive us. We thank you and we love you. You know, it wouldn't be a bad thing to do on a regular basis. The water near you or any of the waters around the world can certainly benefit from our good thoughts and prayers. Well, listeners, thank you so much for tuning in another Wednesday. I hope you enjoyed the show as much as I have. And next Wednesday, we will have on the show Charlene Spretnak. She's going to be talking about her new book. I believe it's called Relational Relativity. I hope I have that right because I'm going by memory. So until next Wednesday, have a good week and good night. Ten.